All right, 1 Samuel chapter number 22. Now, what's been taking place is David has left Saul's palace, and of course, he's not left on good terms, and he escaped to the place called Nob, where the priest lived. Ahimelech the priest is there, and of course, he gets some bread, and he gets the sword of Goliath, and he goes to Gath, the last part of chapter 21, and he changes his behavior because he realizes this isn't going to work, and he escapes being taken captive there at Gath, and he's just in a very awkward position at this point, and he is really the anointed king in type, but he's not in the place where God has put him yet, so he's a type of Christ in exile. And so you're going to see a lot of this as we go through Samuel, with David as being a type of Christ as the anointed king, but he's not received yet. Just like Jesus Christ was the king of the Jews and they rejected him. All right, 1 Samuel 22, verse number 1. David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. I don't know if they're on these maps, but if you know where, it's right around this area right here where Keilah is. There's Adullam right there. And there's a lot of the caves in there. They say some of these caves are over 100 feet in depth. So there's some pretty big caves back in there. Plenty of room for people to get in there and hide out. So notice verse number 1, David escapes to the cave of Adullam. So he's going to places to try to get away from Saul, and he's having just to, you know, forage and live out on the land. And that's a great type of Christ when he was in his earthly ministry. A lot of people think of Jesus in his earthly ministry like he's some big evangelist or something, going around and having all these hotels to stay in and stuff. But he said in Matthew, he says, the foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. He didn't have a place like that. He is just sleeping out in the open. So David's a type of Christ in that sense. Come over to Psalm 57. A couple of psalms. Notice these are actually historically coinciding with the text we're reading about here in 1 Samuel 22. Psalm 57, you see the title, when he fled from Saul in the cave. And you begin to read these things and you realize, okay, there's obviously historical context that we're reading about here, but then you realize what's going on in the heart of David. Verse number 1, be merciful unto me, O God. Be merciful unto me, for my soul trusteth in thee. Yea, in the shadow of thy wings will I make my refuge until these calamities be overpassed. I will cry unto God most high, unto God that performeth all things for me. He shall send from heaven and save me from the reproach of him that would swallow me up. Selah. God shall send forth his mercy and his truth. My soul is among lions, and I lie even among them that are set on fire, even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows, and their tongue a sharp sword. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. They have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have digged a pit before me, into the midst whereof they are fallen themselves. Selah. My heart is fixed, O God, my heart is fixed. I will sing and give praise. Awake up, my glory. Awake, psaltery and harp. I myself will awake early. I will praise thee, O Lord, among the people. I will sing unto thee among the nations, for thy mercy is great unto the heavens, and thy truth unto the clouds. Be thou exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let thy glory be above all the earth. Look over in Psalm 142. Now there is another instance when David's in a cave, over in 1 Samuel chapter 24. So if you were to say, is this for sure the cave of Adullam? I don't guess I could tell you for sure. It just says a prayer when David was in the cave. Psalm 142. I cried unto the Lord with my voice unto the Lord did I make my supplication. I poured out my complaint before him, I showed before him my trouble. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then thou knewest my path. In the way wherein I walked have they privily laid a snare for me. I looked on my right hand and beheld, but there was no man that would know me. Refuge failed me, no man cared for my soul. I cried unto thee, O Lord. I said, thou art my refuge and my portion in the land of the living. Attend unto my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than I. Bring my soul out of prison, that I may praise thy name. The righteous shall compass me about, for thou shalt deal bountifully with me. All right, come back to 1 Samuel 22. So he escapes to the cave of Adullam. And notice it says, when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. There's a few names that you're going to start seeing pop up a little bit later on. We're going to see a guy named Joab. He becomes the general of David's army. We're going to see a guy named Abishai and another, and their brothers, another brother named Asahel. And they're all the sons of Zeruiah. And that's David's sister. So these are David's nephews. And they become, and this guy gets killed by Abner, which was related to Saul. But Joab and Abishai would be some guys that will stick by David for a long time. And Joab's a great, mighty warrior. He becomes a general. Later on, he's very corrupt. He's a self-opportunist. And he actually goes with Adonijah against Solomon when Solomon becomes king after David. But these are his nephews. And you read another guy, Amasa, later on, that David's going to put over in Joab's office. And he was another one of his nephews, I think from Abigail, David's sister. So you'll see a lot of the family throughout this whole thing in the life of David. Just like when you read about his grandfather and his father, his grandfather as far as related to Bathsheba. You'll read about Ahithophel, which would have been Bathsheba's grandfather. That is one of David's great counselors. So there's a lot of family and stuff, kin, that's connected here. And of course, we've got his mother and father going to be mentioned just a little bit later on. So the reason this is happening, because when Saul, you think about these kings, when they go after an enemy, they're not only going to get at the enemy, they want to get at whatever leverage they can use against the enemy. And you think about it, if somebody can take one of your loved ones and family members hostage or captive, they can get you to do whatever they want you to do. And so his family's not safe. And those old kings of old, they would take any type of enemy that they had or any insurrection, and they would kill not just that person, but anybody related to them. Anybody that might be a sympathizer with the enemy. And of course, David's blood kin, they're going to be on David's side. And so they are in danger too, so they're escaping. And then it's going to grow. It's not just that. Notice the next thing in verse number 2. And everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. I believe this is speaking specifically to soldiers, more than likely. The word captains used. I believe these are the mighty men. You're going to read about some of them later on in the Chronicles. And these are people that are in Saul's kingdom, and they're in distress. These are probably some of the biggest supporters David already had. Remember, he was a captain in Saul's army, and he already had a lot of people following him. And people were just saying, Saul has slain his thousands, but David's his 10,000s. And he had a great, huge following. People just knew, they could feel the presence and power of God on him, and he was the ruler, he was the leader, and they knew it. And these warriors, they'd follow him. But here you have David, how he's got all these people already following him. And so notice it also mentions those in distress and then those that were in debt. Remember when Saul became king, he began to levy all those taxes. Samuel protested and told him, look, if you get a king, he's going to start taking portions of this and portions of that, and you're going to be in debt to him. And so there's a lot of people, they already owe Saul so much, they're like, man, I'm in debt to this guy. I'd just rather, you know, file chapter 7 or 13 or whatever it's called and get out of here. And they're just leaving, and they're going with David. And then notice also the ones that are discontented under Saul. And so these are obviously some reasons for these people to leave Saul's army and to follow David. And there's 400 guys here. Now let's look at it in a devotional sense. This is a great sermon. It's got three alliterated points. And David's a type of Christ, so the people that would come to Christ, notice the first ones will be those that were in distress. Look over in Matthew chapter 11. So as you read through David's life, you know, think about the type of Christ, and you'll see a lot of these things. Matthew chapter number 11, verse 28. Jesus speaking, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." So those that were in distress, and you came to Jesus Christ to find rest. And the world doesn't give rest, and Saul doesn't give rest. But under David, they found rest. And then we have, of course, we could go to many verses. I guess go to Romans chapter number 5. Those that were in debt. Romans chapter number 5. Well, Romans 5:8 would be good. But God commendeth his love toward us, and that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Much more than being now justified by his blood, we shall be saved from wrath through him. So he paid the debt. And then what about the discontent? What about discontent? Come over to Philippians. Philippians chapter 4. In Christ, not only is the debt of sin paid and the debt's gone, not only is your stress relieved because Jesus Christ gives you rest, but notice Philippians chapter number 4, instead of being discontented, you know, a lot of people in the world, they're chasing after all these things. I mean, you know, when they're young, they're chasing after relationships. They get married, they get their families, they start chasing after maybe their careers. They're chasing after maybe the next big boat, the next big car, the next big material thing. They're trying to find something that's missing. They try to find it in money. They try to find it in pleasure. They try to find it in meaning. You know, go out and save the owls and save the whales and do something good, pick up trash on the highway. You know, tell somebody to do whatever, to whatever thing they're trying to find meaning for. They're trying to fill that spot. They're discontented. The only way you're going to have content is to find the purpose that God made you for, and he made you for himself. And the only way to find that is in Jesus Christ. God created us. And until you find God, you're wandering around trying to figure the thing out. And notice in Philippians chapter number 4, and Christians make the same mistake of going back and trying to find contentment with the things that didn't satisfy. If those things didn't satisfy you before you were saved, what makes you think they're going to satisfy you now? You fall into this prey, the prey of the devil, this lie of the devil, thinking that, oh, I'll be happy if I have this, or if I do this, or do the other thing. No, your contentment comes in Jesus. Not in circumstances. Look in Philippians 4. Paul got a hold of this. Verse number 11. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I've learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. I know both how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ. He says, I can have nothing and I'm all right, and I can have a whole bunch of stuff and be okay. There's some people that don't need money and things because it will ruin them. Some people can't handle it. Some of you, the worst thing that happened to you is somebody to dump a bunch of money in your lap because you wouldn't be in church anymore. You wouldn't. You have too much going on. Have to have a boat, and you have to be in the boat every weekend. Have to be in the RV, and you couldn't make it to Sunday school because you've been out on Saturdays doing all these other things, and you just don't need that. Best thing for you would be barely get by. You know, Solomon makes a statement about those things. He says, feed me with food convenient for me. He says, don't give me too much so I, you know, take your name in vain. Don't let me steal, you know. He says, just feed me with what I need. God knows what you need. And that thing about being content, you need to be content in Jesus. You say, well, I need something other than Jesus. Well, that's a twisted outlook. That's not right. And sometimes you got to have everything taken away to realize all you needed was Jesus all along. All right, come back to 1 Samuel 22. So this is a great devotional application. All these people that are in distress, in debt, discontented, they come under David. Now notice he becomes a captain. Here's another type. Think about this. Hebrews chapter 2, what is Jesus called? He's called the captain of our salvation. So in a military sense, we think of us. Paul says we're soldiers, right? We're soldiers warring a good warfare, 2 Timothy chapter 2. Paul said, I fought a good fight. So if we're soldiers in the Lord's army, then Jesus is our captain. And so we can look at this devotionally and think about David as being the captain. And you come discontented, you come distressed, you come in debt. And you submit under David's leadership, under Jesus' leadership. And that's exactly what they do. He's got 400 guys here. Now notice in chapter 23, this thing increases. Look over in 23:13. David and his men, which are about 600. So he gets a couple hundred extra. So his army grows. Now these are not just ordinary guys. Later on we're going to read when you get to the end of Samuel. I guess it's 2 Samuel. Was it 23? Yes, 2 Samuel 23, you read about his mighty men. 2 Samuel 23, 8 through 39. And it lists some of these guys. You don't have to turn there. But it gives some of their exploits and some of their accomplishments. These are some mighty warriors that David has. These aren't just, you know, some little soldiers that don't know how to load their rifle yet. These are guys that know how to fight. A force to be reckoned with. Of course, Saul's got 3,000 soldiers. I mean, he's outnumbered big time. All right, 1 Samuel 22, 2. And everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab. I don't think that's been identified exactly where that is. Maybe close to Pisgah where Balaam gave his prophecy. Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me. And he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while David was in the hold. The hold is the cave, the place where it's safe. All right, so he brings his men, he brings his mother and his father here to Moab. Come over to the last part of the book of Ruth, Ruth chapter 4, and notice the reason he did this. Ruth is right before Samuel. The reason Ruth is in the Bible is because of King David. The book of Ruth. And notice, look at the genealogy here. In Ruth chapter number 4. You know the story. Ruth is a type of the footsteps of the church. I mean, she's a Gentile that marries a Jew. A great type picture of the church in type. But she's also a Moabite. That's where she's from. She's from the land of Moab. Remember Elimelech? He went to Moab with his sons, and then they married these Moabitish women, Orpah and Ruth, and they didn't have any children. And then Naomi, his mother, after he and his sons died, she says, look, I need to go back to Bethlehem. And so her and Ruth make it back, and then Ruth, of course, walks all the way from Moab right into the arms of Boaz. And Boaz marries her, and she has a child from him. Notice in Ruth chapter number 4, verse number 17. And the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, there is a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. Naomi, of course, would have been his grandmother, but she helped wean him and raise him. And they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. So when you trace that thing back, Ruth is David's great-great-grandmother, and she's a Moabitess. So David's got a little bit of a connection with Moab. Now, Moab's over here, right here, south of Ammon. So he goes over here and takes his mother and father over here for them to be safe while he's over here back at the cave of Adullam. And that's the connection he's got. Come back to 1 Samuel 23. Verse number 4, he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in the hold. And the prophet Gad said unto David, abide not in the hold, depart, and get thee into the land of Judah. Then David departed and came into the forest of Hereth. Again, we don't know exactly where that forest of Hereth is at. Somewhere in that same area outside of where Adullam is. But notice here, this prophet Gad shows up, and you'll see him a few times. There are two prophets. Turn over to, let me find one reference that's got both of them in it. 1 Chronicles 21, I think. Gad is the prophet that told David about the judgment God would give him when he numbered the people. You remember when he went out and numbered the people? And God said, you know, choose what judgment you want to have. Gad is the prophet that pronounced that. 2 Chronicles 29. There's another prophet named Nathan. 2 Chronicles 29. And he is the prophet. He's the prophet that told David about his judgment that he was going to get when he committed adultery with Bathsheba. So you had Nathan and you had Gad, both as prophets. Yeah, look over in 1 Chronicles 29. I'm sorry. 1 Chronicles 29, 29. Now the acts of David the king, first and last, behold, they are written in the book of Samuel the seer and in the book of Nathan the prophet and in the book of Gad the seer. So where are those books at? I don't know, unless they may be Chronicles. There's a bunch of books mentioned in the Bible that were not preserved. God could inspire a book, but not necessarily preserve it. Paul mentions writing a book to the Laodiceans, a letter to the Laodiceans, which we don't have. There's a lot of books that are mentioned, but there's records that are recorded. But notice he's got two prophets. He's got Nathan the prophet, and he's got Gad the prophet. The word seer is the same word for prophet. It's somebody that can see in the future, a seer. And so he has these two prophets over him, and they help him, and they have a rough task sometimes. Can you imagine being one of these prophets? I mean, you got a king in front of you who has the power to take your life, just like, all he's got to do is say, kill him. You know, and you see that with Ahab and some of the other prophets, you know, when they get mad at somebody like Ahab, he takes Micaiah and throws him in the dungeon when he prophesies against him. Says, feed him with bread of affliction and water of affliction. And so he had that power. Can you imagine having that pressure on you? It's like, okay, I'm going to speak the truth and it might cost me my head. You know, it's one thing here in this little bit of great liberty that we have to stand up and preach the truth, knowing that you probably won't have any repercussions from it. But can you imagine realizing if I say this, it might cost me not just maybe my job, but it might cost me my life? And so these prophets, man, they had to have some boldness and some courage. I mean, they were called of God. Look over back over here in 1 Samuel chapter 22. So here's Gad, and notice that the advice he's given him seems to be crazy. In other words, David, come out and expose yourself to Saul. Come out of the hold. But David listens to him. It's one thing you find about David. When he gets rebuked, he always seems to take it. You know, he can take it, and he listens. And so he comes out. Verse number 5, he says, depart, get thee into the land of Judah. Now what happens because of this? Well, you see it. Verse number 6. When Saul heard that David was discovered and the men that were with him, now Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. Then Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, hear now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? What he's doing, he's trying to appeal to their materialistic sense. In other words, David doesn't have any money and a power and authority. I can promote you. I can help you in your careers, in your military careers. Make you captains of thousands and hundreds. Verse number 8, that all of you had conspired against me, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you that is sorry for me, or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day. Now notice verse number 8. Look at the self-pity in this thing. I counted me and my 8 times. Verse number 8, and you have 8 me's and my's. Me, my, me, my, me. There is none of you that is sorry for me. Self-pity is demon-inspired. I mean, this is a guy that's just full of demons. And he's all about self. And he's just stuck on himself. He doesn't care about what God's will is. He doesn't want to see God's will carried out. If he did, he would have taken off his robe like Jonathan and put it on David and said, hey, you're the guy, you're the anointed, not me. But he didn't. There's none of you that is sorry for me or showeth unto me that my son have stirred up my servant. He's pretty mad at Jonathan. And he knows that Jonathan has sided with David. And he's just trying to put the word out, trying to find out any intel, if anybody knows where David might be and so forth. Verse 9. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him victuals and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. Victuals is a little bit different pronunciation. In the south, we'd call it victuals. I don't know if you just don't pronounce the C or how it works. But we say victuals. Fix up some good victuals. You say, what is victuals? Victuals would be white acre peas and cornbread and fried pork chops, collard greens. Now, if you're up north, victuals would be pasta and bread and meatloaf, I guess. What do they call it up there? Pot roast? They have pot roast up there. But victuals. So he says he gave him food. And notice in verse 10, he says he inquired of the Lord for him. That's a lie. There's nothing in the text anywhere. If you go back to 21, where Ahimelech is inquiring of God for him. So we're going to see who Doeg really is in a little bit. There's one thing for him to stand up and answer and say, okay, I owe it to you. I work for you. You're my boss. I saw David such and such a place. But there's another thing to slander Ahimelech here. Notice verse 11. Then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests that were in Nob. And they came, all of them, to the king. And Saul said, hear now, thou son of Ahitub. And he answered, here I am, my lord. And Saul said unto him, why have you conspired against me? thou and the son of Jesse, and that thou hast given him bread and a sword, and hast inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as at this day. Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, And who is so faithful among all thy servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goeth at thy bidding, and is honorable in thine house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Be it far from me. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant, nor to all the house of my father. For thy servant knew nothing of all this, less or more. And the king said, Thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. Now Ahimelech's just being straight up honest with him. He's like, look, you could tell when Ahimelech met David, it seems reading in between the lines, he was a little apprehensive, kind of wondering, what are you doing here without a sword and stuff? And he gives him the sword of Goliath. But I mean, David is the captain of Saul's army. I mean, he's equal with Abner, or just about equal with Abner. Abner's the general. And he's thinking, he's the king's son-in-law. He goes out at your bidding. I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't know anything about a conspiracy. Of course, maybe he did know. It was all throughout the land, I think. People knew that what was going on. But he makes this point, and what is he going to do? I mean, if David was coming with uprising, David could easily have killed Ahimelech. I mean, why is he getting mad at Ahimelech? What this shows you is when somebody is twisted in their heart, their judgment is twisted as well. You'll see things, when things do not make sense, there's something else behind it. Okay? I'm just going to say this one thing, and you can't help but saying things about that. I'll tell you one thing. When they will willingly, in our society, set somebody down and put alcohol in front of them, knowing they're going to get up and go get in a car, and they will not make any type of law saying you cannot have this if you're driving, but they will make a law saying you have to get a shot or you have to get such and such, something's way skewed. Something's way out of line here. There is another spirit going on right now in this country. And as we're studying our things in prophecy, you're going to see the spirit. It's the spirit of Antichrist is what it is. And you've got this thing where when something doesn't make sense and you begin to look at it and you say, okay, here's the data, here's what's going on, and here's the response of things, and it doesn't make sense, there's something else behind it. When people are unreasonable, you knew so-and-so, you're so-and-so's uncle, and your nephew committed a hate crime, so we're firing you, you can't work here. I didn't approve of what my nephew did. You're fired. Well, last year, that stuff was happening all over the country. Say, does it make sense? No, it doesn't make sense. Right down the road, just saw it right in Jefferson County. Big sign on the interstate. Call the FBI if you see a hate crime. What does that mean? That means if you talk against someone's perversion, they'll wind up throwing you behind bars. I heard a story on the radio of a lady, and I need to look her up and find her name. She played for some soccer. I think it was women's soccer team. I don't know if it was Olympic level or what, on some high level. But she came out back in 2015 when they did the whole rainbow over the White House and they did the legalized sodomite marriage and stuff. She came out on her little social media and all she said is, Jesus Christ and the Bible doesn't change regardless of society. That's all she said. She didn't come out and actually get specific. Well, they began to, they call it cancel culture now, where they cancel you out and they begin to put you out. Well, whenever she did finally make the team, I think it was 2017, she made the team. And on this, whatever the highest level, women's soccer team, whatever the thing is, on their uniforms, they were going to, the United States put a rainbow in support of the sodomite stuff. And she said, I can't be on the team. And she made a stand and said, I can't wear this. I can't do this. I think they said that she made the statement that maybe the whole reason God gave me this talent and abilities was for this time right here where I could turn down the team. Hats off to her. Got more guts than a lot of preachers. But that's the type of stuff that we're seeing. And it's eventually, once they get the legislation behind them, there's no way you're going to be able to stand up and preach some of the things we preach here. But you know, like I'll say later on as we get in this prophecy series, we talk about all this stuff having to happen, then when it happens, we get mad about it. We ought to be excited about it. Hey, there's got to be globalism. It's got to take place. Man, this thing we know as great freedom has got to crumble and fall eventually. But when we see it falling around us, it's not very fun. But anyway, so you've got all this twisted perspective. When people are unreasonable, you deal with unsaved people and you begin to see that in them, you realize, okay, this person is completely blinded. They're lost. They don't know Jesus. They don't have the Holy Spirit. They don't know the Bible. They don't have any sense. No wonder they're doing the stupid and crazy things they're doing. No wonder the right hand don't know what the left hand's doing. And Saul is just completely out of balance here. And he's going to wind up having all these people killed. All right, come back to 1 Samuel 22, verse number 16. And the king said, "Thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house." It doesn't make a lick of sense. Ahimelech's not to blame for any type of uprising. Verse 17, "And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, Turn and slay the priest of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled, and did not show it to me. But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priest of the Lord. And the king said to Doeg, Turn thou." Now see verse 17? We all get to places where we have to make a choice. And they had to say, okay, I'm not going to obey this order. You know, people, and I know eventually we're going to see later on, Saul's the one who had him killed. You know, but just like I mentioned alcohol earlier, you know. Well, you know, you got to make a living. I think, and I'm sure there's been some saved people that have worked in places where they've sold alcohol. But I'll tell you one thing, if I was working at a grocery store or I was working somewhere and I had to literally sell that stuff, I would have a bad conscience. Here I am selling something. Well, you're not selling it. You're not putting it in your pocket. You know, it's the store that's doing it. Okay. You're running it across the thing, handing it to somebody. They're taking it. They're getting drunk. They're going off the road. They're killing somebody. There you go. Well, you know, I just drive a beer truck. It's no big deal. I just work for the cannabis place. It's no big deal, you know. Okay. These guys said, you know, he's given the order, but it's still not right for me, literally, to kill this guy. These are tough decisions. Can you imagine being in some type of military, whether it be ours or whatever, and they say, we want you to kill these people. And you're like, okay, you're the one having to kill them. You better believe in what you're pulling that trigger for. Well, I just, you know, God bless America, I'm called. Okay. At the end of the day, you're the one holding the sword. And so a lot of times I think people make excuses for stuff. Well, it's just my job. It's just this. Okay, you're the one going to give account. And these guys, they stood up and said, I can't do this. These are the priests of the Lord. They're innocent. I can't do this. Verse 18, the king said to Doeg, Turn thou and fall upon the priest. And Doeg the Edomite turned. He didn't even think about it. This shows you his heart. This guy's wicked. And Doeg the Edomite turned, and he fell upon the priest and slew on that day 85 persons that did wear a linen ephod. And Nob, the city of the priest, smote he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and sucklings, and oxen and asses and sheep with the edge of the sword. And they wiped them out. Verse 20, and one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priests. Notice verse 21. It goes back to who gave the order, Saul. Hitler never fired a shot except the one in his own head at the end of the war. But he killed a lot of people. The blood's on his hands. Those guys that were over the different concentration camps, you know, they're not the ones, you know, actually pushing the people in there, but it's on them. It's on all of them. And Saul gave the order, so Saul slain the Lord's priests. Notice verse number 18. It mentions the linen ephod, and then of course the ephod that the high priest wore, Abiathar is actually going to bring down to David. We're going to see that in the next chapter. Verse number 20, one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priest. Verse 22, and David said unto Abiathar, I knew it that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house. Man, it hit David like a ton of bricks. He's thinking, it's all on me. What have I done? That shows you the difference in people's hearts. Saul didn't even feel bad about killing these innocent people and women and children. And here's David that he was not directly responsible. He was indirectly responsible. And he looks at himself saying, man, it's my fault. That shows you the difference in attitude there. You know, Doeg didn't have to, he might have had to tell Saul, but he didn't have to kill him. And Saul surely didn't have to kill because of this. But he's guilty. Verse number 22, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house. Abide thou with me, fear not. For he that seeketh my life, seeketh thy life. But with me, thou shalt be in safeguard. Here's another type of Christ. Our safety is in Jesus. If we abide with Him, our safety is in Him. And we're in safeguard with Him. You know, when you think about salvation, the reason that we have eternal life is not because of a contract that you made with God based on stipulations. Lord, if I'll be good, will you save me? That ain't how it works. You can't be good. You are no good. I am no good. The contract is made between God and Jesus. Jesus lived the sinless life that you couldn't live. He died the death to atone for our sins and to satisfy God's judgment and justice. So atonement was made. There's a contract made between God and Jesus. And if we trust Jesus, we're in that contract. And we're safe. So long as we're with Him, we're safe. And so that's a great comfort for us. And Abiathar, he knows if he stays with David. And he does stay faithful to David. Now later on, way after everything happens with all of this, and David becomes king, and then David eventually passes on the throne to Solomon, and David dies, Abiathar does conspire with Adonijah to try to take over from Solomon's throne. And then what Solomon does, Solomon kicks him out of the priesthood. And that fulfills another prophecy. But when he kicks him out, he says, I'm not going to kill you because I'm just going to kick you out of the land because you stuck with David, my father, and you were persecuted just like David, my father. So he's blessed in that regard. All right, we'll stop there in 1 Samuel chapter number 23, 22.